Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Say what? Check it out, man. Rapping the best about infinite tennis. Radio show so dope, gives people a voice. Homeboy, don't test this. Hosted by Bill Petty, making things happen. Only good, email them, yes you should. InfiniteTennisDay@gmail.com. Over and out late. Now reach out for tennis, real lessons and info. All you should go and tune into Infinite Tennis. You already know who the best. Oh yeah.
All right. Hello, hello, and welcome to Infinite Tennis. I'm your host, Bill Patton. Infinite Tennis is sometimes clever, but never cute. And if it's trying to be cute, it's definitely a mistake. Alan Margot, who is a tennis pro in Northern California here, and he hosts a site called clevertennis.com. He's a terrific guy, and we're going to get him on the line shortly. But right now, it's time for a quick message here.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com.
Hi, this is Alan.
You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and where you're from and what are you currently up to?
Oh, that's a good one. I am the tennis director at the Atherton Tennis Center in California, and they also have a company called Clever Tennis. .com, and we do tennis, getaways, travel, video instruction all over the planet. So that keeps us having a lot of fun and staying busy.
All over the planet. How many continents do you go to, sir?
This year we went to the Australian Open for 10 days, got back, went to Nuevo Vallarta, Mexico in February, to Indian Wells. For the Open there, the Paribas Open. Then we went to Carmel, Pajaro Dunes, and in September we were at North Star Tahoe. So we take about 25 to 30 people, 6 pros, and play tennis almost 5 hours a day. So lots of fun, great camaraderie, great dinners.
So you're just never home.
In between the trips, I'm home. Yes, coaching. Yes, I am.
So tell us a little about your growing up and learning how to play tennis.
Wow, that's an experience in itself. I grew up in a very small town in the San Joaquin Valley called Porterville. Population was 3,000 to 4,000 people. And played on the same courts my dad played on in high school. They hadn't been resurfaced, so they were very good asphalt, cracks all over the place. You really had to watch the ball to make contact.
Yeah.
And my parents would play on weekends for the fun of it, and I started playing with my dad when I was 12. And we'd go out and play on the weekends and have fun. My dad was my coach, and he kept it very fun and enjoyable. And that first summer of 12, I played tournaments. I played 9, and every Monday was a new tournament. Porterville was just inside the Northern Cal border. We were an hour from Bakersfield and 2 hours from L.A., but we had to drive into the NorCal district, which was up to the Bay Area, which is 5 hours. So I played 9 tournaments that that summer, we at Station Wagon, we drive up, I play a match, lose the match, have lunch. We came back, I played 9 matches, lost every match, and we had a great time. It was all fun and learning about the game. Never won a match that year. So that's where it all started.
You know, that there's a great lesson there for a lot of people. And I've heard similar things from other people who reached some pretty high levels is getting over the early losing and still maintaining some perspective. That's remarkable.
Well, that was my dad's approach, which helped. So,
what was kind of the height of your playing career?
Well, when I was 15, I was top 3 in the U.S. three in NorCal. Qualified to go back and play the Nationals. I was top 30, had a great time in junior tennis. 65. That was when I was 15. Went back and played the Nationals. That was right during the riots, which was an incredible period of time on this planet. And being out from California, we were kind of sheltered from all the riot stuff that was happening in the South. And I remember I took a bus from Springfield, Ohio, the tournament there in Springfield, and took a bus to get to Kalamazoo, Michigan. Spent 13 hours on the bus. We stopped in Toledo, Ohio at 2 a.m. in the morning. On the way down there, the people in the back of the bus were black, and they were all singing, having fun, and all the whites sat in the front. So I worked my way to the back with another guy named Paul Sedoni, who was there with me, and we sat in the back and sang in the back of the bus with the black people, and all the whites just stared at us, didn't know what to think of us. Were we crazy? And we weren't sure if they were going to get mad and beat us up, or they thought the blacks were. But we had an incredible experience for us. We didn't know any better. We knew things were not good, but they seemed friendly, so we were happy back there.
Stuff like that's just irreplaceable. I mean, that's a priceless experience right there.
Well, we were ignorant, and so it was, yeah.
You know, that's a whole other topic, is the joys of getting lost, you know, and the stuff that you find when you don't know where you're going.
Right.
Yeah, we could do a show on that, but... you know, that's an interesting theme among people of my generation and the preceding generation. I think you're just a little ahead of me, but kind of the adventuring, barnstorming nature of getting out on the road. And, you know, it's sad, but with many of the helicopter parents that are currently in charge, kids don't really get to have an experience like that.
That's you're exactly right. From there, I had more experiences. I traveled in a van 1 year on tour after I got. I went and played for Stanford, graduated and played there. My year, 73, was the first year Stafford won the NCAAs. I played on a team with Roscoe Tanner, Sandy Mayer, great players. And that was an exciting time of life. So I got out and traveled after that on tour for 3.5 years through here and overseas and had a fabulous time.
Back up to Stanford. So what influences did Dick Gould have on you?
Great influence. He is an incredible coach. He knows how to work with people. He had a team. He was best in keeping everybody from having fist fights. There were a lot of big egos on that team, a lot of powerful players. Tanner was 5th in the world at the time. And I tell you, there were big issues with challenge matches and where everyone thought to play. And Gould was so good at keeping people calm. He'd go out in the middle of a match, and instead of telling you how to play or thoughts, he'd say, hey, buddy, what you have for lunch today? And you'd look at him like, what? I had a peanut butter sandwich. Okay, you go do it. And, you know, sometimes that was just enough for focus to where you think this guy's going down and you compete better. At other times we talk about game situations, what's happening, but he had the whole picture wrapped up well as to what you needed in the moment. So it was fun.
You know, it's funny. I stole one of Dick's great things that he ever did, and used it a couple of times. And so he would do a thing in a tight match where he would go to the player and say, "Hey, look, come here. Hey, I have nothing new to tell you, but I want you to walk away from this little talk while we look at them. You're going to walk away from this like I just gave you the advice that's going to make you win this match." And I've done that, gotcha. And it's really amazing how that gets in the other player's head. When you
it does. I used that also when I coached college tennis for 10 years, 11 years. But any of those thoughts are important in a match because it sometimes it's the attitude. And you can give a kid a great attitude of thinking, hey, you know what, I'm going to act this way. And sure enough, all of a sudden actions become live and results happen.
Yeah, yeah. So that's very interesting. Okay, so now you want to get on to your van story? 10 years ago I had a tournament, and we had a rain delay, and it looked like it was going to be pretty significant. So we knew we were going to be rained out for about 3 hours, but that we would probably play. So I challenged everyone at the tournament to go to lunch with the opponent that they were currently in a match with. Absolutely nuts, but two people took me up on it, and they became fast friends, and they reported back, and I said, "Wow, thank you for that, because we would have never become friends if you hadn't done that." So,
no, that's very powerful. Wow.
Isn't that, this is one thing, I think both of us, I think I'm feeling the same thing from you. It would be great if every pro found a way to get opponents to view each other as potential friends and to work towards that end. And then I think that's one of the most significant solutions to the American tennis problem, if you will.
Yeah.
We look at each other as part of a team and we're all cooperating to get further down the road, then everything will get better. All right, now.
Completely agree with you.
Let's get into your coaching career. And when did you make the transition from playing to coaching, and who were some of your influences in simply how to coach tennis better?
Well, part of it was my dad, who was my coach, and his view on how to coach comes from the idea of the line I still use today, rumor has it, it's a game. And the idea, if you're not having fun, you're not learning. And because it's these days it has become so serious that a lot of times kids lose the idea that it is a game and it is fun. And sometimes it's searching to find the fun in a game again to let it flow so that players play better. I started at Menlo College. Actually, I was at the Menlo Circus Club in Atherton for 3 years after I got off tour. And then I went, I opened up a pro shop in town, sold that, and moved. Then I went over and coached at Menlo College for 10 years and ran summer camps there and coached juniors. I had the honor from the NorCal USTA to start a program called Junior Excellence for juniors. And as you were talking earlier, that was, as you were saying earlier, what we did is got the top three kids from each age division to practice with some of us pros. And that was very difficult because tennis pros seem to want to own their kid, as you know.
Yeah.
And this is where we got them together to play matches and get, because they didn't want to practice with each other because they didn't want to lose to each other in the tournaments because they were 1 and 2 and 3. But we broke down that barrier where we learned to play together in the idea that the best player you can practice is the one
studio.
Who's just a little bit better than you. And how to play. So all these kids eventually became friends. We got a better idea of competing nationally at that time. This was
then the live
70s
portion
so
is
that
gonna,
we could compete in the national tournaments against
the
other
podcast
kids.
Will be available
we practice better.
Shortly at the completion
of the
comp.
Were there any names that people might recognize in that group?
Lindsay Bartlett, Shelley Bartlett. Steve DeVries, good players at the time that NorCal had, Lisa Green, players that turned pro and played, competed, internationally.
That's great. Yeah. Has kind of helped shape your tennis coaching in terms of philosophy of how to coach, teach strokes, strategic underpinnings, and whatnot.
Other than my dad, who we played daily as a junior, and his, I would almost call it clairsentient feeling. His idea was you need to sense and feel what's happening in your hands. Can you move balanced? Can you move centered? How do you build a game place? I think there are so many life lessons through tennis that people can learn: how to stay balanced, how to deal with pressure, how to deal with fears, how to, you know, from double faulting or a set point. Those types of thoughts of how to become more confident in yourself and believing in yourself through tennis. And basically that's what he preached, that. He sold his business, built a tennis club in Porterville, did that for 20 years, and that's the way he taught. And for me, that was the answer, that it is a game, and if you can learn to be patient with yourself and still keep the joy in competing, I think there's great answers there in life lessons of learning to handle yourself better and to compete better.
You know, that's remarkable, because I guess your dad is one of those unsung heroes who doesn't, you know, go to the fore. He doesn't jump to the front. He stays in town and builds his thing, and maybe not too many people know who he is, but he's been great. And you've been very influential. So, you know, let's hear it for your dad. That's great.
Yeah, I think he is my life teacher, as well as tennis. I mean, that we looked at the game as an extension of you, and I as I coach these juniors and these teams that I work with, I remind them that, one, remember it's a game. And two, when you build your competitive zone, your zone space, make sure you are your best friend, not an enemy. You need to stay calm and keep yourself focused and moving in the right direction. So those are those little keys and things you all learn. Listen to your breath. I think your breath is the closest thing to you. That keeps you centered and in the moment. It releases fear. You can refocus where you are and continue forward in your matches.
That's amazing. That's great stuff right there. We're going to go to a commercial, and then when we come back, then we're going to talk about Clever Tennis and how that got started and what's it all about. So we'll catch you on the other side here.
Sounds great.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At ussportcamps.com, you can plan out a Nike Tennis Camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit ussportcamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike Tennis Camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike Tennis Camps and take your game to the next level.
Okay, so we're back. And so, Alan, what is Clever Tennis, and how long has that been around? How did you start that?
Clever Tennis started in 2007, and basically the thought behind that was being able to show on the court video instruction of how tactics and strategies are done. It's more of how to play doubles and how to compete and things of that sort. So we shoot video, and I do it wrong. I do it right. So you get both sides of the coin, and a lot of them are set to music, so you can see what we do. And from that, we put together a DVD on how to hit a penetrating forehand volley off a slow ball, and that does well. And from that, we got into boot camps, and we did I bring in pros, and we would do a weekend boot camp. And then from that, we got into doing, actually going away to resorts, leasing the courts for 3 days, 4 days, or a week, 8 days in Mexico, things of that sort, where you bring in pros, you play 9 to 12, and then you're off 12 to 3. 3 to 5, you're back playing doubles with us. We're working on the tactics and the strategies of what we did, poaching whose ball is who and where, how to cover the middle, fun stuff like that. And then catered dinners in the evening, or the resorts were all inclusive, so we've touched on a little of everything that we do there.
I like the part where you do it wrong, because I think sometimes people don't have that contrast. So what? Give us an example of doing it wrong and then doing it right.
Oh, okay. Here's one of the – an example would be in doubles, because it is a doubles site. Your partner, let's say it's 15 all, and you've got a rally happening, and you get a cross-court volley hit to you, and your partner doesn't move over, and it's hit in the middle between you, so you learn to move over. Next example is your partner now learns to move over with you because you're outside. Let's say you're outside the alley, and your partner moves to the middle to cover, which is correct, and the person hitting the volley in the deuce court goes back cross court to the opponent, who then hits down the line because the line is open. Then that person says, hey, watch your alley. Well, that person moved over to the middle with you correctly to cover the middle. That ball should have gone down the line, not cross court, to allow the opponent to hit to the open spot, open court. So
yeah.
There are examples like that. You do it wrong and you think, well, now that makes sense, where before you thought I should go cross court to keep it away from the person in front of me. So different things like that. What happens is you hit a ball to the middle, and middle basically brings middle because it's a reflexed action, because in the moment you've got a partner next to you, not sure whose is whose yet. So you hit the ball to the middle, and you go back to cover your side. And sure enough, it's reflexed right back down the middle. And you think, oh, okay, nice shot. Instead of hitting in the middle and closing on the middle, staying in the middle,
yeah,
Walking that white line. So that's an example. Basically, I would say it's targeted to, say, the 4-0 level. We, from 3-0s, get it. 3-5s start to sense it. 4-0s do it. 4-5s say, yeah, I totally am on it. And you learn to move up in the levels with the strategies. It's basically the way the pros play. Communicate. I feel you learn from errors, not winners. If you're not making errors, you're not learning, because that's the feedback for change. So showing it, doing it wrong, and you go, well, God, that was obvious. I don't do that. Well, maybe I do, but that's how you learn. Just showing it, hey, okay, this is what happens, and it is in the game.
When it comes to doubles, what are some of your kind of key philosophies of you want to teach some people who want to go from 3-0 to 3-5, what are some things that you're looking for to make sure that they can do so they can go from there to there?
One of the biggest things I see, I lease the course from the town, and they do not generally allow teams to play there. We're one of the few little towns and cities that do not have teams, so I coach teams that play for other clubs and come in to see me. And what I've noticed, the 3-0s, let's take the 3-0s for example, when they are taught by basic club pros and people to keep the ball deep, high over the net, maintain depth, because they're still working on consistency. As you move up the levels, in doubles, the tennis ball that's hit tends to get lower. 3-0s hit above their heads, by their heads. 3-5s hit shoulder length. 4-0s start to hit just above the net, so the ball starts to stay down. So a lot of times you see a 3-0 get too tight, and that's my biggest pet peeve, is a 3-0 has been taught to close quickly, and then they can't do a good job on the volley because it's a little high out of their reach. If they learn to stay back a little further and close quickly, things get better. I think it's easier to move forward quicker than it is to move backwards. my biggest thing, and we all teach through all of these, the pros that I bring with me that come with me, our biggest thing on clever tennis is to move forward and hit down. You want, if you're not winning, you're having a popcorn rally. Pop, 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 pop. And no one's hitting down to get a ball up to close quickly and hit down again. So that's, I think, learning to keep the ball down is critical. And we practice a lot of that with the teams at every level, starting with the 3-0s. Moving forward, hitting down.
You ever get people misinterpret what you're saying and then they end up hitting balls in the net?
I would so much rather... and this is another thing we preach, I would so much rather have in doubles someone hit a great volley and hit the tape rather than hitting it long. If you hit the tape, you're an inch from brilliance. It's right there. And it's a reference point. If you hit the ball long, you've missed 30 feet of court and you have no reference to look at. It's out in the ozone. If you hit the tape, you're 15 feet in front of the tape. Look at the tape. Let your look and say to yourself, "I'm going to raise it up 2 inches." Like a gun sight on a gun. If you raise it up 2 inches, your computer, your inner game will say, "Okay, I know where the net is," and it'll raise it up. Your computer will adjust so you have a reference point to hit higher. It's right there in front of you. So I think that it's silly, but
yeah,
it works.
Tell people ollie straight ahead, you know, because then the gravity is going to bring the ball down. Yeah, and then we talk about, you know, keeping it low, and then, you know, then you get a couple of balls in the net. Yeah, you tolerate that error. But if you're getting two in a row in the net, then something, that's a red flag, right?
Well, if you hit two in the net, I don't think it's a red flag. I think you need to either you're hitting down on your volley instead of forward, or you need to look at the net and raise it in your mind's eye up a few inches. It is a reference point. People don't think of it that way, but we teach that. I think if you hit the ball in the net, look at the net if you're on a volley. Ground strokes are different, of course, but if you're right there in front of the net, hit the tape, that's different.
Okay, so a player wants to now move up 3-5 to 4-0 or above. What are the next objectives for them as they do that?
From 3-5 to 4-0 and 4-0 to 4-5 are very fun cues. The main thing, you've got two things. You've got players that play as well as 4-0s but don't compete as well. Part of that is a learning curve. The other thing is, as I tease everybody from moving from 3-5 to 4-0 or from 4-0 to 4-5, you got to get out of dial-up. You need a faster chip. It's a faster computer. It's a matter of being quicker, seeing it sooner, responding faster, recovering quicker, so that you can hit the next ball. 3-5 hit three great volleys and missed the fourth volley because they didn't recover. They were caught in the moment of excitement and didn't stay, you know, didn't pull that racket back in to recover to make another clean volley.
Does that mean when you say that 3-5s play almost as well but they don't compete quite as well? Is that what that means?
Right. Part of the thing is there's a confidence thing that happens when you start to make that fourth ball. And to get to that point, there has to be some steps before that, such as learning to recover, learning to stay balanced, learning to stay in the moment, seeing the ball sooner, expecting. As I wrote in my e-book last year, you need to hit recover expector on that. We've got some great – that is a wonderful book. Everyone should read it. It's how to think like a pro, not like an amateur. And regarding the paradigms of how people think about playing tennis.
So tell us about expecting. What is that all about?
In a point, what most people do is they hit, recover, and they wait to see what's coming back. They're looking to see. They are not. And then when the ball is hit back, there's that volley. There it is. Part of it is seeing is expecting a shot to come back. For example, if you hit a ball deep to the baseline and your opponent's backing up in the defensive position, as I write in my book, all of a sudden the ball goes up and you go, "Yep, I knew it. I saw her moving back. I knew she was going to lob. Yep, she did. And I can't reach it." If you see it sooner, you can expect it. If you see her backing up, you should be backing up. I guarantee you she's at the base. If the ball bounces near the baseline and she's backing up, she's not going to pass you if she's running backwards. Seeing it sooner and expecting the lob, and then 4-0s, 4-5s start to do acting in the moment of backing up before she hits or as she hits, not after the ball is above your head. So that's expecting and seeing it sooner. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And so it really gets into kind of reading the game and understanding people's tendencies and also what many people commonly do in a certain situation.
Believe me, it is a game. You can learn. People learn to hit the ball well, but it's how can you learn how to play the game so you can read an opponent? How can you learn to win? Where does the ball go? I've got a chapter in the book called Mikey Likes It. And if you've hit a ball and you're to a certain place and your opponent just rips that winner and likes doing it, you should expect it. So what you're going to do, you're going to hit that ball and in the moment cover it, not wait to see, yep, I was right again, but cover it and go down the road, the path of hitting the ball somewhere else and seeing where the game goes from that point. What does your opponent do if you cut that winner off and hit it somewhere? Do they lie?
Right. You know, it's funny, I was playing a match over the weekend and really tough lefty, and I could barely return the guy's serve because he just had the wicked juice on every ball. So late in the match, what I did is I just moved over to make him have to serve the ball to a certain place, and he didn't like that. And so I forced him to have to hit to my forehand. Then on the second serve, I moved over so that he would have to hit to my backhand, and then he double faulted. You know, that's kind of an example of what you're talking about is you can dictate play, and if you know that person loves that little wicked angle and it goes there and they've done it twice, well, you need to stand 2 feet more over to start to take some of that away. Maybe force them to hit it perfectly and then they'll miss.
Right, or in a rally, you know they're going to go to their go-to shot, their favorite shot, and the trick is not to say to yourself, yep, I'm right, but be there before or as he hits it. Be in the moment knowing he's going to do it. Here's a fun little trick for you, Bill, and you'll love this one. Next time you go out and you're playing a tough match, move up one step, a half a step, not two, just a half a step, maybe 2 feet on that first serve. As soon as he tosses, move back. But not enough for him to adjust. Because what happens, people don't look at the line. They look at the line to serve, but then they look at you. And their reference point becomes you over time in a match, not the line. So if you move up 10 inches, 6 inches, a lot of times that first serve will hit the net. Just tape the net because he didn't recognize the picture is a little different. Just like you moving over one side or the other, moving up or back changes the depth also in a person's mind, in the mind's eye.
That's like psychological warfare right there.
It's a game, Bill.
No, that's sneaky. You know, one thing I notice among players who aren't that experienced is you tell them to lob a person, and then what do? They lob right to them. Perfectly, you know? So, because they're looking at the person, they're lobbing the person becomes their frame of reference. So I started to tell them, lob to the baseline, over them.
Lob. Excellent.
So now they're lobbing deeply up over the top, and they're not really thinking about the person until then they don't lob. So, yeah, it underlines the idea that you're expressing there, that there's so many little things about what attracts our mind.
Let's take that thought, Bill, and change the look at the other side of the coin. Let's put it that way. Let's be the guy or the gal who is going to be hitting the overhead. If you hit a deep ball and you come in, that person looks at you, as you said, which is correct, you as the frame of reference. So if you lob and stay deeper, I mean, if you come in and back out a little bit before they lob, they're going to look at you as the reference, not the line. So a lot of times they'll hit it over your head because you are back behind the service line, not in tight. That's another fun trick.
But the mistake that people make is that they just stay up there close to the net hoping for a bad lob so that then they can crush it from closer to the net.
Well, yes, it's part of human nature. You hit a great ball, I so own you. We do a video on that on Clever Tennis, I so own you. You hit a ball and you're coming in, I'm going to put you away, and oh, she lobbed, yep, she did, there it goes, The more, the better the shot we hit, the instinct is to get in and put it away. What we forget is the other person is in a defensive mode and is backing out, stretching, reaching for the ball in a defensive mode. The trick is not to close. The better your shot, if you put that thing away, start looking for a lob, back out 2 steps before they hit. And on the other side, it is almost counterintuitive when you hit a weak ball, a short ball, or a bad shot at the net to close. Feeling is, oh no, here it comes.
Yeah.
And if you hit a weak shot at the net, close, because they're not going to lob you. They think, I so own you. So that's when you want to get tight. So it's counterintuitive.
Yeah. Thus the cleverness of the whole thing. You know, let's go back to the going back to the player who backs up because they're expecting a lob. Another benefit of that is that even if that lob goes in, you haven't given them a trajectory where they can hit a lower lob that will really push you really far back. Their lob, by necessity, must go higher and have a steeper trajectory, and then it should bounce up nicely for you.
Mm-hmm.
If you're too close, then you're subject to the lower lob that comes in closer to 45 degrees and which will bounce away from you and might get to the back fence. So that's an additional benefit there. But, yeah, I, you know, it's funny that you should say the thing about the weak, low shot, and then you come and close, because objects in mirror are closer than they appear. You know, when you start coming closer, you also become more fearsome to your opponent, and they begin to think that they have nowhere to hit.
A lot of times they will rush it or hit the tape because you've closed off the open spot. But again, it's counterintuitive. It doesn't feel right when you hit a weak ball to close. You want to back out, which is just the opposite of what you should do. Yes, you're right on that lob with the lower trajectory. They've got to hit a higher ball. Also, I would so much rather be in the position if I have to make a choice of moving in a direction to move forward first. I think if you're in a place where you are 50-50, she could lob, she could pass. I don't think you're drawing the right shot. I would rather be back to draw an aggressive shot and close as she hits, or seeing her back out in trouble, lobbing and backing out. So that's just the way that's my philosophy.
I like that. So now we're getting towards the end here, and tell us about your trips and how can people get involved in that? I mean, do they have to live in the area here to meet up with you, or can they find out about the trips through your website and sign up?
All our trips are on our website on the Getaways tab, which is clevertennis.com is the website. We are online, so our trips we take, we get people from all over. Our last one had people from Texas, San Diego. We've had people from you name it, almost every state. I can't say that, but a lot of the states from neighboring, you know, Colorado, Utah places, and they will meet us. They'll fly in. We bring the pros. There's a price for the resort where it's all inclusive, and it makes it a lot of fun. We do a lot of 3 and 4 day getaways, and then we did some bigger ones last year. You can see all of that on clevertennis.com. We've got a series of videos coming out. This coming out probably in the next month or two, hopefully, when we finish editing, on different situations. It's going to be called Clever Moments, and these are thoughts you can take on to the court. One of my pet peeves, and Bill, you're probably familiar with this one too, people don't practice as much like they used to. They don't train. They'll go play a practice match in doubles.
Right.
And so these are thoughts. You can take a match out onto the on your service return today. Make sure you move forward, and we'll have an example of how you don't want to do it and how you might want to do it. And so you can have one focus in your match to practice your game while you play a practice match.
Yeah, I think that's very wise, because getting people to change away from that practice match mentality, I mean, it's just, they're like dogs with an old sock. You can't get it away. So that's a way to make that happen, so that they have an objective in their practice match that they're working on. So, all right, well, hey, thanks so much for coming on the show. I need to clear the line so the next host can host their show, and there's another one coming up. And you have so clevertennis.com is the way to reach Alan, and as you can tell from our conversation, he's a fun guy, and you'd love to spend time with him. And I guarantee you that you'll get a unique perspective on how to play this game. So, because, I mean, I just learned some new stuff today that I had never, ever thought about before. So thank you, Alan, for coming on the show. Have a great day.
Thank you, Bill. It's been a pleasure and having fun with you. Thank you very much.
All right, take care. We'll be in touch for sure.
All righty, thanks. Bye-bye.
All right, everyone. Bye-bye. All right, so I'm going to clear the air here, and it's time to go, so I'm just going to play the disclaimer this time, so here we go.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.